From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, voters in 58 communities across Massachusetts are at the polls today.
I think that's exciting. I think that's change, and like the people who represented us should look more like the communities that they're representing.
Also today, the founders of The Hard Times on the punk scene, satire, and why they made paying their freelancers a top priority.
I don't want anyone's first experience writing on the internet and getting paid to be a bad experience to deter talented people from joining this industry.
And the debate over Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All.
She's taken on every billionaire and every corporation in America. But when what's at stake is the restoration of our Constitution and democracy, I bet most Americans wouldn't take that bet.
Where do you stand? We'll take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Election Day. With people in 58 communities across the state, including Boston, Fall River, Cambridge, Somerville, Newton, and Lowell, headed to the polls today. As Secretary of State William Galvin reminds us, it matters.
These are the important races where you live. These are the important issues to determine what things will be like in your community. They shape the future of your community.
In a few minutes, we'll check on the polls in Boston. But first, WBUR's Callum Borchers is on the line from Alfred Letourneau's school in Fall River, where there is a hotly contested race for mayor. Callum, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey there, Tiziana.
So, Callum, what's happening where you are?
The main thing, as you may be able to hear in the background, is it is pouring in Fall River, Tiziana, and that's leading to some nerves by the frontrunner, Paul Coogan. I ran into him in the last hour. He was here with his fellow sign holders at the entrance to the school and a little bit nervous about the turnout on such a dreary day. He was saying, you know, if I thought I had this one in the bag, I'd be home watching Jeopardy reruns or something to help me stay loose on Election Day, but instead he's here. Trying to stay dry and trying to turn out every last vote.
What has turnout been like, Callum?
Well, it's hard to tell at this early stage. Remember, polls are open until 8 o'clock, but it appears that it's actually going to be pretty good. So at this elementary school that I am at, there are two precincts represented. And if you sort of extrapolate the turnout here, if this is typical across the city, you're looking at somewhere between 20-25% of registered voters who've already cast ballots so far. That's pretty good. The numbers would be pretty close to what we had in the preliminary election earlier this fall. And so, of course, we'd expect a wave of people to come after work between 5 and 8 p.m. So if that's the case, then it looks like turnout will be fairly decent today, despite the weather.
So what's the mood among all the people turning out?
Well, there's really no joy, Tiziana. I mean, the people who are here have their favorite candidates. But remember, this is the third election day that we've had in the last just a few months since March. And so, you know, the folks who are here, even if they are getting behind Paul Coogan or maybe Kathy Ann Viveros, who's mounting a write-in campaign, you know, in some ways it's a sad day, because what this means, of course, is that the young mayor, Jaisal Correa, that a lot of residents had so much hope for. Remember, he's still in just his 20s. You know, this guy was kind of a beacon of hope for the city in a lot of ways. And so his fall from grace in recent months has really, I think, sort of sucked a lot of the energy out of it.
And just clarify for the listeners who may not remember, what do you mean by his fall from grace? Why is there not a lot of joy in the moment today?
Yeah, boy, how much time? There's quite a tale to back up. About a year ago, last fall, he was indicted for the first time by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, charged with defrauding investors in a startup that he had launched before he became mayor. He has denied those charges. And then more recently, he was indicted a second time, this time charged with sort of bilking money out of pot shops that wanted to get their licenses here in the city of Fall River. And in between, he survived a recall election in March. And then in the preliminary election earlier this fall, he was trounced by Paul Coogan, roughly 4-1. And at that point, he decided that it was time shortly thereafter to bow out. But he's still on the ballot, Tiziana. So the ballots were already printed. He advanced to the final election today, but he suspended his campaign and is not officially running. But his name is still there. It's still technically possible that he could be reelected.
Okay, so have you had a chance to talk to voters? What are they telling you about how they feel about the mayor's race?
Yeah, well, so one voter I talked to is Julie Jasmine, who's really hanging in with the mayor until the bitter end. She voted for him in the preliminary election just a few weeks ago. And she says that as far as she's concerned, he's still innocent.
I really believe that he is innocent until proven guilty. That's why we have the courts, and I really, really believe that.
But Tiziana, she's not holding out hope for a miracle win by Jesuel Correa today. She's instead getting behind Kathy Ann Viveros, who is the city administrator, who is mounting that write-in campaign. And I found another former Correa supporter, a fellow named Ron Savigny. He, though, has gone with the front-runner Paul Coogan. Again, he voted for Correa right up until the preliminary election, but he's decided that that's a lost cause. And he's getting behind Coogan today. Here's what he told me.
City's in nowhere land right now. We'll see what happens. I say a prayer for this guy. I think I met him a while, and now I realize that one-to-one, I found out what he's made of, and I feel hopefully that he can pull this off and we'll have a new beginning.
New beginning, really the theme there, Tiziana. You know, he was describing to me this incredible dysfunction that's existed between the city council and the mayor. Whether you think he's innocent or not, I think any observer would say not a whole lot has been able to get done because the city council and the mayor haven't been working together in recent months. So you heard from Ron Savigny there saying, we're looking for a new day where we can get back to running the city business as usual.
So, Callum, briefly, who are the other players in this race? Tell us some more about people other than Jesuel Correa who are running.
Well, so Coogan is a current member of the school committee here in Fall River, so he's giving up that seat to seek the mayor's office. But aside from that, you know, he's not sort of a well-known quantity here. And so when I asked him earlier, what do you want people to know about you, aside from the fact that you're not under indictment and you're not Jesuel Correa, he said, look, I want people to know that I'm a really hard worker, and I want them to know that I'm honest. You know, keep in mind that Correa got into office because the last mayor was recalled before him. So this is a city that's been through a lot. They're pretty tired of corruption, and so that's sort of the core message from him. And Kathy Ann Viveros is one of the top aides to Jesuel Correa, and her supporters are hoping that if she can pull off a write-in victory today, that she will kind of carry forth what they see as positive reforms that they've seen under Jesuel Correa, just without the distraction of a federal indictment.
So it's going to be interesting to watch. Callum Borchers, WBUR reporter, thanks for joining us from what sounds like a very rainy Fall River.
Glad to be with you.
All right, now moving our attention to Boston, where voters are choosing the next city council. There are eight candidates running for four at-large seats. And then in the district races, five councilors face challenges, while four are running unopposed. Just in the at-large race, the challengers include three women and three people of color, which sets the stage for possibly the most diverse city council in Boston's history. Voters are also weighing in on a non-binding ballot question to change the name of Dudley Square to Nubian Square. WR reporter Simone Rios has been out covering the vote. He joins us on the line from our bureau at the Dorchester Reporter. Simone, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
So are you dry?
I'm trying. I'm still dry enough from the last poll I was at.
All right, so tell us what's happening at the polls you've been at today.
You know, so it's still early. There's another 5 hours to go before polls close. Turnout is already looking to be low. Pollster Steve Cazella of WBUR's partner Mass Inc. is estimating turnout will be somewhere between 15 and 20%. As you said, though, it's also kind of a nasty, rainy day out there, so that's definitely not helping the turnout in any way.
So you've also been, you know, you've been in Mattapan, Dorchester. What are you hearing from people? What's the mood among voters?
I got to say, it was pretty subdued where I was, both at Morningstar Baptist Church in Mattapan and at Viet Aid in Dorchester's Fields Corner. There were a good amount of people at the polls, but they were mostly campaigners or poll workers, only a few voters coming in and out. Some people complain that the city could do more to encourage voter participation, but given that these aren't national elections, it's not that surprising to see turnout at these levels.
Sounds like you haven't seen a ton of voters, but have you had a chance to talk to any of them about why they are turning out today?
Yeah, one of the things people are talking about in these elections, as you pointed out, is the possibility that we get a majority women or majority people of color council or both. I spoke to Laverne Suri from Mattapan. She says electing a majority minority council was not her primary reason for voting today.
That's not my number one priority, no. I'm trying to get someone that I think that will do a great job.
I'll just note that Suri is African-American, and I spoke to Jackie Stevenson, who's white in Dorchester, and she says she feels the identity of the candidates really does matter.
I think that's exciting. I think that's change, and like the people who represented us should look more like the communities that they're representing.
So, Tiziana, you know, this election season, I've been out a lot covering the different races, and I've picked up on a lot of identity politics, you know, several of the candidates talking about their race, their sexuality, their immigration history, as really vital aspects of their candidacies.
We know that has been a big part of it, Simone. What other issues are on voters' minds today?
Well, Laverne Suri, who we heard from, said her number one issue is the cost of housing. And that really seems to be a predominant issue on people's minds. I'd say it's true for 90% of the people I talk to when I'm out covering elections now and in the past. As for Jackie Stevenson, she said housing and homelessness were her top concerns. But as a charter school teacher, she said she was interested in hearing more about school choice. And she didn't hear enough of that from the candidates. That's the program that allows kids to study in communities other than where they live.
So very briefly, Simone, today Boston voters are also voting on this non-binding ballot question, rename Dudley Square. What are you hearing about that, or is there a brief background you can give us?
Yeah, so Dudley is considered the heart of Boston's Black community. It's named after a 17th century governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. About 5 years ago, the Nubian Square Coalition formed to rename Dudley Square. The name has a double meaning. A Nubian notion was an Afrocentric gift shop in the center of Dudley that closed about 2 years ago. And the Nubian Empire refers to the region of Africa along the Nile River. The city council supported this renaming unanimously, as did Mayor Walsh. Now we'll see what the voters say.
That's WBUR reporter Simone Rios. Thanks so much, Simone.
Thank you.
We look forward to bringing you key election results tomorrow on WBUR and Radio Boston. In the meantime, polls are open into the evening in most cities and towns. Not too late to vote. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tom Waits giving out rusted harmonicas to any trick-or-treaters who visit him at Haunted Junkyard. Okay, that's not true. But it is a headline from the punk culture satire website The Hard Times, as is Pretentious Friend Only Listens to Podcasts on Vinyl. The Hard Times was co-founded by comedian Bill Conway and former SF Weekly music editor Matt Sankum, along with Matt's brother Ed, and it now boasts more than 2 million visits per month. Bill and Matt are in town for an event tomorrow night at the Brookline Booksmith, and they stopped by our studio. We started with the unexpected success of the site.
I think it was almost instantly surprising that we just figured we were kind of going to be making jokes for a couple of our friends, and then more people than our friends started paying attention to it, and we said, all right, well, I guess we'll keep doing this.
Yeah, I've never done anything successful before this. All my bands were the type of bands where we'd go and we'd play for 30 people in basements and stuff, like here in Boston. We went on U.S. tours a couple times. We would travel the whole country, and we'd make 100 new fans, and we go, wow. That's
some
great.
Back only losing $400 and be like, wow, we nailed this one.
We nailed it.
All right. So now that you're so popular, does it make it scarier to be free with your humor and your content? Or are you just keeping it as real as it was when you were doing basement bands with music?
I think that we have a little bit of a separation between us and all of our readers. Like, we don't see them in real life very often. Sometimes we'll come to a music festival and they'll run up to us and show us a Hard Times tattoo on their arm, and we'll be like, wow, that person's from Australia. There's a lot of reach here. But at the same time, it's still just Bill and I in our bedrooms writing jokes and stuff. So I do think that we're still as true as we ever were. It feels very normal still.
And we have a lot of contributors all over the country and various, you know, experience with DIY music or where they are. So their experience also becomes part of the website as well. And we, as the editors, really need to just focus that. So the outside voices really help with that. And so, because Matt and I probably would have ran out of jokes a long time ago if we just had to mine our own experiences. But a lot of the contributors help with that.
You guys founded the website in 2014. A lot has changed since then, and not the least of which is the emergence of this concept of fake news. I have to believe it's very hard to do satire in the area of fake news? Is it harder either to get people to read the content, understand it in the right way, recognize it as fake in this new environment?
We had basically every big tech company go to war against us, and it felt very weird. Our traffic plummeted on our site about 70% overnight via several algorithm changes that were targeted towards fake news and disinformation and all that sort of stuff. And we really had to fight and claw and scrape to get our way back up there. But we're really lucky. We have a really dedicated, loyal fan base, and they helped us out a lot.
So when you say they went to war on you, at first I thought you meant they said, let's all go after the hard times. But what you mean is they were going after their algorithms that were allowing fake content to come forward, and your business essentially suffered as a result of that?
Yeah, we got swept up in the, they just had a, they didn't really care who they were affecting. They didn't want to put in the work to actually go after fake news and who's doing comedy, which we were, and so a lot of the people that would follow us on social media, all of a sudden they weren't seeing our stories anymore for no reason of their own. And then they'd be like, wait, the hard times are still around? Like a year later, like, yeah, we've been busier than ever. But
yeah, you can check the metrics. And it used to be maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we would put out a joke and about 2 million people would see it on Facebook. And now the same sort of joke, about 100,000 people will see it. So it's not just a small incremental change that they made.
That's a huge change.
It's a very, very big choke that they put on us. And then they want us to pay money to get over the choke, but it's very expensive and we don't have that money. So we say no. So we had to go find new ways to get to our audience.
So your audience, it's interesting to me because the focus of your satire is essentially the punk scene. Okay, let's go back to 2 million hits a month, the punk scene. I didn't even know the punk scene was big enough to garner that. What makes it ripe for satire and why are people finding it so funny?
We have expanded out quite a bit past our early roots. I like to think of it now as it used to be jokes about things that were going on at a DIY basement show. Now it's jokes from people who go to DIY basement shows, but maybe it's about society at large. So I do think that some of our traffic and some of our users are from that world. We also expanded out into video games. We have a vertical called Hard Drive, and we have a satirical presidential candidate called Ace Watkins that's very popular, and that makes up a bulk of our traffic too. So it's not just 2 million hardcore kids with hard times tattoos on them. It is growing to be a more and more diverse audience.
Talk a little more about Ace Watkins, who is funny, and why you decided to do that and why skewer politics.
So that all started with Jeremy Kaplowitz, who was the... So Matt and I have been kind of run the hard times side of our website, and early on, we kind of pinpointed, like, where can we also expand, like, what markets aren't being served with these jokes? And the video game nerd culture market was one that we looked at early on. So we looked into our contributor pool that we already had people writing for us and thought, like, who would be good for this? And there was one guy that stood out, Jeremy Kaplowitz, who had created his own comedy properties, but he's been heading up Hard Drive at the editorial, and he just, threw that presidential candidate out as a joke one day, and it kind of just started to stick. And
can you describe Ace Watkins a little bit?
He's the first gamer running for president. He believes that there needs to be RGB lights underneath the White House. He's played by Phil Jameson. a YouTuber, and he's just held his first presidential rally in New York.
He cracks me up.
He's got like 170,000 Twitter followers and growing every day. He's overtaken many actual presidential candidates in social media engagement. we're all in for Ace Watkins. I'm
voting for him. So if he accidentally makes the next debate stage, is he going to show up?
I think they need to start counting IGN polls in order for him to get in.
So one of my favorite headlines as I was preparing to see you guys is from an article a couple of years ago called Punk Dad Can Still Hang Maybe Next Friday Between 5 p.m. and 8 p.m. or potentially two Saturdays from now, but only during the day. And Matt, that makes me think about what you were saying about this broader audience who's living in society and experiencing this tension between who you want to be and you want to think you still are and who life is actually making you be.
Bill, who wrote that one?
I think it's Randy Labasso that wrote that one, if I'm not mistaken. That speaks to a lot of our demographic is kind of the people that have, not aged out of punk or anything like that, but just real life is kind of more in the way where work and responsibilities of parenting, but you still have that connection and So those jokes like that, like the office punks and the punk parents really tend to hit with a lot of people.
You guys have really, in a way that's quite specific and distinctive, committed to making sure your freelancers are your priority,
mm-hmm.
committed to making sure that they get paid. Bill, I think you stayed part-time until quite recently, and mm-hmm. you've even released a platform for paying freelancers that puts a priority on them getting their income quickly. Mm-hmm. That is not industry standard. Why are you
We're trying to make
so,
it a standard.
Yeah, it seems yeah. like you are, and I noticed in our conversation today how mindful you're being about talking about your contributors. Why is this such an important part of the way you're running this business?
I think it comes back down to, you know, so when you grow up in a punk scene, you get these ethics embedded in you in a weird way, and you bring those into adulthood, and that's just kind of how you live your life. And so, like, being part of a community is always a big thing. But Matt comes from the journalism world, and paying contributors was a priority from the start, where when we didn't even have money coming in, we're still paying contributors whatever we could pay them. And yeah, like you said, I worked part-time at the Hard Times for the first 4.5 years of the site, working in warehouses and then going home and basically doing a full-time Hard Times job at night. And but thankfully now I'm full-time with the Hard Times, but that paying of the freelancers was such a priority because we wanted to reward the people that put in any time for any stupid thing we wanted to do. We wanted people to feel respected and that their work was valuable. And that was always very important from the start. And we actually pushed other publications to start paying their contributors in a certain way.
Well, I was going to ask that. Are you changing the industry?
I think that we're the second highest pay rate for satirical writing on the internet. And a lot of other people gave up when those big dips happened in the algorithms. I know Above Average and Funny or Die were going after satire for a while, but they gave up. And I think that it's just a little bit who we are. I went through the journalism world, and I wrote a couple of super viral articles as a freelancer, and I got these calls from my publishers or from editors being like, man, this is incredible. Can you write another one? This is the biggest hit traffic piece we've had all year. And I thought to myself, that's great, but I only got $35 to write this thing. I had to go pay for the parking myself. I took the photo myself. It was all my work that went viral. How about I am the guy who gets paid when the work goes viral? And so once we went from being, Bill worked in a warehouse. I worked as a reporter. Once we went from being like the underlings up to the bosses, we wanted to try to change a little bit about how bosses treat underlings. The freelance payment platform that we built, it's called Outvoice, and what it does is it allows publishers to pay their freelancers as soon as they hit the publish button. So there actually isn't a publish button on Hard Times. There's a publish and pay button. And as soon as the article goes live, the writer gets a notification, the payment gets sent out, and it all gets perfectly tracked for tax season. There's actually a lot of other things that we did at Hard Times that are very unique for freelancers. We built a community for our freelancers, and we make sure that they understand what direction the magazine is going in and what our objectives are. They have monthly get-togethers. There's groups based on locations. There's like a Hard Times LA group. There's a Hard Times New York group. They do comedy projects together. So we're trying to help freelancers build their networks of creative people, get paid on time, get respected, use Hard Times as a launching off platform.
So I have to ask you, as an uninitiated, those things that you just laid out sound like a good way to run a business, mm-hmm. And a way that develops your people and helps them develop themselves. As an uninitiated, that doesn't sound very punk to me.
No.
Connect the dots. Seriously, connect the dots for me. You are guys who grew up going to basement DIY
mm-hmm.
punk shows
mm-hmm.
In subcultures all around the country, and now you're running this enlightened, web-based, cutting-edge moral business in the gig economy, and I need you to connect the dots.
So punk does have a deep, like, there's, you know, you might have the view of a punk as like somebody that's like throwing up on the sidewalk and, you know, spitting in your face or something.
Nihilistic.
Actually, for me, it's mostly Green Day, because that's who my kid is into.
Okay, yeah.
Sure. Green Day likes our website. We just sent them a book.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, so there's a lot of, a lot of times in punk, like, certain moral values are in punk first, and then they get mainstream, like a call-out culture, like the Me Too movement. Kind of started in punk 2 or 3 years before it became like a mainstream thing. There was a lot of people calling out banned people in power and stuff like that. And like, you know, veganism and like all that runs deep in the punk world. So
I don't think people know that.
Yeah. And so these sort of things of being a community, and it's all deeply ingrained in the punk. So the initiated know that these things, like a lot of punk shows are charity drives and stuff like that, that help, you know, feed homeless people. But you know, you just see a bunch of people moshing at a show and you think it's violent and weird or something like that. But it's often very altruistic.
All right, I want to play a quick cut of a song from the book release album. It's called "Can Punks Even Read Though? I Really Hope So, We Just Wrote a Book."
I hope punks can read. Yeah, I hope punks can read. Because we just made a book.
Okay. So, you poke a lot of fun at the people whose scene you're still connected to. I've read an interview where you even expected to maybe get beat up some for that. How is this really intense scene doing such a good job, having such a good sense of humor about you poking fun at them this way?
I think most people get the joke in that we are just having fun with it, and that there are some, we have seen people, you know, if we write a headline that affects them, they get upset about it or whatever, but it would take a lot of effort for somebody to find us and beat us up. So I think that's really what it's all been. It's the
only
way
we stay hidden.
Too hard.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a journalist, I was on a conference or a press call with Carrie Brownstein from Portlandia, and she said something like, well, we aren't making fun of people who we aren't a part of these communities. We're making fun of ourselves, and that's why it's okay. And I thought about that a lot, and I had a contributor, Bobby. Someone was having a conversation about punching up or punching down, and he said, you know, a lot of times with hard times, it's just a bunch of punks running in a circle punching each other, right? It's just a big circle pit. We do that for fun. And so I think that because, I mean, punk was the first type of music I liked. You know what I mean? I just trying to mimic my older brother, and he got me into it. And so my entire life is in the punk community. So if I'm making fun of punks, it's not like some random person just spitting down on someone.
We're not the jocks making fun of punks. Yeah. You know, we're the punks. We mentioned we're both straight edge. A lot of the articles we write are most harshly reflective of straight edge people, you know?
So it's sort of like you're allowed to make fun of your own family, just no one else.
Yeah. It's like the, what was that, the Blue Collar Comedy Tour? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
It's like the Blue Collar Comedy Tour.
We are the Jeff Foxworthy.
Yeah, here's your sign. Is that punk? Here's your sign.
All right. That was Matt Sankum and Bill Conway, co-founders of The Hard Times. Matt and Bill will be at the Brookline Booksmith tomorrow night at 7. You can find more information at our website, radioboston.org. So stay with us. Coming up, now that we've seen the numbers, is Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All plan realistic? We'll dig in and we'll take your calls. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have been hearing a lot about Senator Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All plan, and on Friday, she finally unveiled how she would pay for it. Higher taxes on billionaires and big corporations, which she says will generate trillions of dollars in revenue. It's an ambitious endeavor, so ambitious that Saturday Night Live couldn't resist making a joke out of it.
When the numbers are this big, they're just pretend. There ain't no Scrooge McDuck vault. You ready to get red-pilled? Money doesn't exist.
So now that we've seen the numbers, do they help or hurt Warren's case? Let's first turn to WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Bricks. Anthony, welcome back.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
And Anthony, just quickly join me. I'm going to ask the listeners to call in as well. Do you think Medicare for All is a good idea? What about your current health insurance? Do you want to keep it? Are you worried that Medicare for All might take away what you've got and what you like? Or maybe you prefer Medicare for All. Who want it? We want you to join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Anthony, can you help us break this down? How does Elizabeth Warren say this is going to work?
Right. So she says she's going to raise $20 trillion over 10 years, and she would get there by imposing higher taxes on the very wealthy, basically doubling down on her billionaire's tax. She would hit Wall Street by taxing financial transactions. Corporations would face higher taxes. She'd also require employers who are currently paying for health care right now for their employees to essentially redirect that money to the federal government. So that raises a lot of money. She would also try to reduce the price of health care by paying doctors, hospitals, and drug companies less than they're getting now. And a lot of money would also come from savings, in particular from the high overhead costs of the current system. That would be wiped away. And of course, she does all this without raising taxes on the middle class.
So you're out there. What do you think the reception's been? How would you characterize it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because even before this came out, I think a lot of folks are in line. And when I say folks, Democrats out there on the campaign, they get what Warren is trying to do. And health care comes up a lot. And I think people are responsive to that. But, you know, our own polling shows that while there's a lot of support for Medicare for All, more people favor fixing the current system and adding a public option. So I think she's taking a bit of a political risk with this, to say the least. And, you know, the reaction has been pretty swift from both sides. And I think this is going to be a big theme in the coming debate. We're going to hear a lot about this. And she's going to be, I think, put on the defensive on this in a lot of ways.
It also sounds, Anthony, like it's kind of raising an electability question again. You know, the size and the scope of this proposal does raise concerns that in a general election, when more than just Democrats will be voting, that she could be vulnerable. What is your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think this just gets down to the fundamental issue that Democrats are wrestling with right now. And, you know, we've got a year to go to the general election to get this, the Democrats do, to get this question right. But, I mean, basically, do you go hard left? Do you embrace a progressive agenda like Bernie Sanders and like Elizabeth Warren to really get that base riled up and out to the polls? Or do you go more toward the middle, Joe Biden's approach, or even Pete Buttigieg? You know, we saw some very interesting polling from the New York Times this week that looked at those key swing states that helped elect President Trump in 2016. And according to the New York Times, to these polls, folks, you know, are much more comfortable with more moderate positions. And if you read into those polls, Democrats might be scratching their heads and saying, you know, is this really the way to go? But, you know, this is a debate that's really going to play out. And speaking of that, you know, when Elizabeth Warren has answered questions along these lines, especially on health care, especially her support for Medicare for All, this is what she said. Here's a bit of what she said last week in New Hampshire while she was campaigning, talking about how she, if she wins the nomination, will bring this fight right to the Republicans.
We will be running in a general election against the Republicans who have already taken away millions of people's health care. So this is going to be a fight, you're absolutely right, in 2020, between the people who think health care should be reserved for those who are rich and the rest of us who think health care should be there for every American. And I'm ready to take that fight on.
So, Tiziana, the point there is Democrats like Warren are saying, look, if the Republicans really want to engage us in a debate about health care, whether it's Medicare for All or public option or whatever it is, we're ready for that because the Republicans have not delivered anything in the last 3 years on health care, on improving health care.
Okay, Anthony, stay with us. I want to bring two other voices into the conversation who will help us look at this from a health care policy perspective. I also want to bring listeners into the conversation. So call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us on the line is Jonathan Gruber, a professor of economics at MIT and a key architect of Romney Care and the National Affordable Care Act. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Good to be here.
Also on the line is John Kingsdale, professor at Boston University School of Public Health and founding executive director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority. Welcome back to you too, John.
Thank you, Tiziana, but nice to be here.
Yeah. So, John and Jonathan, what do you make of Warren's plan to finance Medicare for All? Do you find it to be a realistic financing plan? Jonathan?
I think it is about as realistic as you could get. I think there's, you know, any plan like this is going to make a number of assumptions. And I think she makes, you know, she starts with the most expensive estimate out there, which is from the Urban Institute, and then she makes serious assumptions, which may or may not be realistic. You quibble on them. But the bottom line is, I think this is the most credible plan out there for paying for it. But we haven't gotten into politics. But if you just ask about the economics, I think she did a fine job laying out a sensible plan to pay for it.
John Kingsdale, do you agree?
Well, in a sense. I mean, she's actually constructed a spreadsheet that starts with the right numbers and has a bunch of line items that she subtracts as expenditures she's going to save and taxes she's going to raise, and gets to, you know, by adding those up to $20.6 trillion over 10 years. Not many of those assumptions, however, I don't think are very realistic. For example, there's a couple of trillion dollars of savings by going to payment reform, like bundled payment, a bunch of acronyms that most of your listeners wouldn't even care to learn about. But they've been in place for 5 or 6, 7 years under the ACA. They haven't produced much savings, if any. The Congressional Budget Office, the scorekeeper, gives virtually no credit to them. So, you know, she's put the line items down. I just don't think they're all that credible. And the biggest one, of course, is freezing taxes, on freezing premium contribution from employers. And that raises huge issues in the context in which she proposes it.
So let's take a call here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Sue from Southborough, pull up a chair. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been on Medicare for a while, and I have a supplement plan to pay what Medicare doesn't, and it doesn't cover everything I have to do. But the thing that scares me about Medicare for All is that I am totally embarrassed at the low rates that Medicare pays doctors, and I'm terrified if a Medicare for All plan comes in that doctors will just give up being doctors because they're paid so little.
Thanks for that, Sue. And John Kingsdale, you've expressed, I think, some concern of the impact, the economic impact of changing to this model. I think Elizabeth Warren is proposing that essentially Medicare for All would pay 110% of what Medicare currently pays out to doctors and providers. Do you share Sue's concern?
Not exactly, although there's a related concern I think she's put her finger on. And you know, Medicare for All would be a monopoly buyer. I mean, doctors would, by definition, have no choice, frankly, to accept whatever Medicare fees were paid them, which is one reason that the medical industrial complex, which is 18% of our economy, is going to resist this plan like crazy. But if we got there, and there are a lot of good things if we could get there, one of the problems is it would increase the use of services significantly. There's irrefutable evidence that if you eliminate cost sharing by patients, the demand for services will go way up. So even if all the doctors and hospitals stay in the system, and I think they'd have no choice unless there's some kind of black market way to get around that for patients who can pay a lot, you won't have enough doctors and hospitals. You'll have a lot of queues. So I think one way or another, there'll be some waiting.
Jonathan Gruber, was there any of that present as RomneyCare was implemented or as we saw the Affordable Care Act implemented?
Yeah, there was not. And I simply don't agree that paying doctors 110% of Medicare is going to lead to massive increases in waiting times or other things. Look, providers for medical care are generally overpaid in America. I think that we can do that. I think there's no doubt it will lead to dislocation. I mean, once again, we have to separate the economics from the politics. John's point is exactly right in the politics. You know, the fact that some providers are overpaid, you know, Uwe Reinhardt, the famous healthcare economist, had his Reinhardt's Law, which is that healthcare costs equal healthcare income. You know, the fact that some people, I'm saying they're overpaid, doesn't mean they're not going to fight like hell to stop those overpayments from being cut. So put the politics aside, but the economics, I think there's just no evidence that if we pay providers a little bit less from their high levels, that it would lead to a significant reduction in the in access in America.
Let's take
I think we have plenty of access.
Actually, I'd like to get another call in here, actually.
Sure.
Well, okay, John, go ahead.
Can I just quickly clarify? It's not paying them at Medicare plus 10% that will lead to queues. It's eliminating patient cost sharing. And the Urban Institute, on which Elizabeth Warren bases her numbers, actually projects a 14% increase in demand as a result of that. And
okay,
I think John would agree that, no cost sharing will lead to more use.
Let's move to a call. We've got Olivia from Brighton. Olivia, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling really to sort of clarify this confusion that I'm having and a lot of listeners and news readers are probably having as to why this is being regarded as Warren's bill and not as Senator Sanders' bill when he is the one with a 1,000-page bill on the floor with his name on it. I'm just not sure. It seems almost like a way to discredit and undermine the hard work that Senator Sanders has been doing to create this bill and give all the credit to Warren.
Okay, thanks, Olivia. Yeah, let's turn to senior political reporter Anthony Brooks for that. Anthony, what do you say to that?
Well, no, it's a good question, and you hear this a lot out in the campaign trail from Sanders supporters. I mean, the truth is, the way Elizabeth Warren sort of rode this horse, if you will, for a long time was simply to say, I'm with Bernie Sanders. I support his bill. And then questions began coming up, you know, how are you going to pay for it if you support the bill? Sanders' bill offers a bunch of different routes, essentially, to get to Medicare for All. But his bill doesn't specify exactly how this would be financed. And that's the step Warren took. So Warren has done work on this on Sanders' bill that Sanders didn't do at this point. And in a way, she's sort of taken this issue over and made it much more of her issue right now. But the caller's correct. Warren has always said, and she's been very clear, that this is Sanders' bill that she's supporting. Now she's come up with a plan how to pay for it.
All right, let's take one more call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pamela from Concord, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wish people would stop saying we love our health insurance. Our health insurance is not our health care. They're different things. Nobody loves their health insurance. They love their doctors and their hospitals and their medical providers. Medicare for All won't take away our choice. It'll give us more choice. I'm 100% for it.
Thanks for that. Pamela, let me turn to John and Jonathan on this. So Pamela's making the distinction between payment and providers and the care you receive versus how it's paid for. How should we think about those issues when it comes to Medicare for All?
Pamela's absolutely right in saying that, look, the truth is people care much more about their choice over the doctors and hospitals than over insurance. And that'll go up under laid out as the Warren plan, as expensive as it is. Clearly, there'll be more choice of doctors and hospitals because they won't be in managed care networks that restrict your choice. So she's absolutely right. The problem is that's not how it's being – she's right that there's a perception problem. People perceive, oh, I'm going to lose my choice of insurance. Well, actually, she's right. If Elizabeth Warren could convince people, you know, that actually their choice of what they care about, which is doctors and hospitals, go up. Now, that's super expensive. That's part of why she has to raise so much money to pay for the plan. Private health insurance lowers costs by restricting your choice of doctors and hospitals. That's why they do it. And it's been shown that those restrictions lower costs without actually sacrificing the quality of care. But they do annoy patients. And the Sanders-Warren bill would get rid of those restrictions at a cost.
I should ask actually quickly to both of our guests, John and Jonathan, are either of you doing any advising of Warren or any of the other presidential campaigns on health care as the race progresses?
I am not.
I've seen a couple of the plans, but I'm not advising anyone officially.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. And Jonathan Gruber, I wanted to ask you, there are a lot of large-scale assumptions being made in Warren's payment plan, you know, her plan for how Medicare for All gets financed. Are there any that seem particularly sound or particularly risky to you in your analysis?
I think that her payment plan is pretty sound. I mean, I think the big issue is the issue with her wealth tax, which there's a lot of controversy about how much money that'll raise. There's controversy about how much the original wealth tax will raise, and she doubles down on the wealth tax here. I think that's an assumption which has come under a lot of fire, and I think it's probably too rosy. The other place that's too rosy is she sort of assumes that the IRS is going out to get a lot of money we're owed. America has a large what's called tax gap. About 15% of what's owed in taxes isn't paid. She assumes that essentially we get as good at finding that money as some of the best other countries are. You know, I don't know how we're going to do that. In theory, we could. That money's there. But that would mean a large ramping up in the IRS, which I think raises political problems. So once again, as with both these plans, I think if your question is technically can they be done, sure. Politically, is it realistic? No.
Okay. I think Anthony's
so really
got a question.
Sort of it's sort of more of an ambitious roadmap.
So, Jonathan and John, I have a question for both of you, because one of the things you hear out on the campaign trail, I was at a Pete Buttigieg rally last week, and he talks about Medicare for everyone who wants it as a kind of sensible step toward Medicare for all. He acknowledges that Medicare for all might well be where we want to get eventually, but a more realistic way to get there is to sort of stop first, I guess, at Medicare for all who want it. How do you folks respond to that as a kind of more moderate, gradual step toward Medicare for all?
I think that makes it's a very appealing concept. I think in the United States, you have to appeal and attract people into change rather than force them into it. I think the concept, the challenge with that concept is there's a lot of sort of technical issues with how you lure individuals into Medicare in a way that doesn't actually undermine Medicare. And so it has to be, you know, the devil, I'm afraid, is in the details, but the concept is very sound because I think Medicare has a huge advantage over private insurance, which is it pays much lower prices. And high prices are what make our health insurance so expensive in this country. You can attract people into Medicare if you figure out the right sort of way to do it.
So that makes me want to ask Jonathan Gruber a follow-up question. Any bill that gets proposed, any policy idea is going to go through a sausage-making process in Congress. And one of the things that I've wondered about is this one that has to be passed in total the way it is to work. Do we actually wind up in a worse situation if it sort of gets broken out into compromise bits and pieces and the whole thing isn't there? Or is this just a strong anchor with the knowledge that over time, likely something a little less complete is likely to be what's passed?
I mean, I think, you know, that's a great question. It relates to John's excellent answer on Medicare for All Who Want It, which is the Medicare for All plan that Sanders laid out is a big bang. There's not really a partial way to do it because really it's moving from a system of multiple payers to one payer. You can't. Going from, you know, 100 payers to 50 payers doesn't solve any of the problems she wants to solve. It really is big bang or nothing. And that big bang has proven politically impossible for 100-plus years. And my problem is not with the aspiration laid out in the bill. I think it's great. My problem is with the lack of explanation for how we are going to overcome the fundamental political barriers that have stopped this from happening for more than a century in our country. And that's why I totally agree with John that if you think of Medicare for all who want it as a first step, that makes a lot more sense, a lot more politically feasible.
Let's take one last call. Emmanuel from the South End, briefly, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I've been following the discussion, and I really think what Jonathan said of this being an ambitious roadmap is how we have to look at it. I mean, it's impossible in this current Congress to get anything passed. When you look at Obamacare passed with a moribund Senator Kennedy being rushed out of his sickbed to vote for this thing. I think what Elizabeth Warren is doing, she's offering a vision that people like me who are Generation X can see our children maybe having as good a life as we did because we need a reorganization of our economy. It's really dire right now. And I think Elizabeth Warren, and to a certain extent Bernie Sanders, but Elizabeth Warren has a pragmatism that Bernie Sanders lacks.
All right.
Is the only one out there who's offering a vision.
Great. Thank you, Emmanuel. So, Anthony, is that what you're hearing on the campaign trail in the primary? Are people hungry for vision?
I mean, I think they are. Look, I mean, healthcare is a huge issue, and Elizabeth Warren speaks about it in a very compelling way. Honestly, I haven't been back out on the campaign trail since she has released the plan, so it'll be interesting to see what people are saying and how she's explaining it. What's interesting is up until this point, a typical Elizabeth Warren rally didn't talk about healthcare. It talked about corruption. It talked about any number of plans that she was focused on, from free college and preschool and kindergarten and all that sort of stuff and erasing college debt, but she didn't talk about health care. Now she's going to be talking about it.
That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Jonathan Gruber, a professor of economics at MIT and a key architect of Romney Care and the National Affordable Care Act. Thank you, Jonathan.
Great to be here.
And John Kingsdale, professor at Boston University School of Public Health and the founding executive director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority. John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.